Okay, welcome back. Last class, we had a bit of a hiccup when my computer crashed. Unfortunately, it continued crashing another dozen times thereafter on Monday. And after wiping and reinstalling drivers and doing some other things, I thought I had it fixed. But when I came in this morning, I had another blue screen waiting for me. So we're going to try to make it through lecture. Hopefully everything goes okay. If it doesn't, I'm simultaneously logged in on another laptop. And if anything happens here on my main computer, I'll try to transition over to that laptop and finish out the lecture. So I apologize for that on Monday and preemptively apologize if anything goes wrong today, but hope you'll bear with me. Announcements. Reminder that we have one more homework. It'll be due a week from Monday, last Monday, so whatever that is, 23rd. That'll cover switch cap converters. For at this point, everybody who is planning on fabricating and testing for their final exam, your PCBs and components should have been ordered. The last couple of those were ordered yesterday. And then just a reminder, TN voice evaluations are open and available now for the next couple of weeks. Please do fill those out. Give me your anonymous feedback on the course. I appreciate hearing your thoughts and ways that things could be improved. So last time we were finishing up the SSL, FSL analysis of the standard Dixon converter. Using the 6-to-1 implementation as an example. We had previously solved the slow switching limit output resistance, fast switching limit output resistance of a 2-to-1 converter, and the slow switching limit RO of the Dixon. Last class, we closed that out doing the FSL RO of the standard Dixon. And then we moved over and we're talking about this hybrid Dixon and making some kind of motivational arguments around what this thing can do and how it's going to operate. So we'll pick up there today, looking at the standard Dixon. This bottom half is what we added last lecture, going through the FSL output resistance. To do that, we just needed this AR vector, where we went through and for each FET decided what the charge is that is flowing through that FET when it is on. And took some arguing from the circuit schematic, but was pretty simple to do, where we could just pick all of these numbers off of what we had already done for the slow switching limit impedance, just noting, okay, which of the capacitors charges are flowing through that FET when it's on. So for each of these six in this series stack here, just sees one capacitor's current when it's on. And then this full bridge down here at the bottom, these two devices see all three of these capacitors current, all three of them in parallel flow through either this FET or this FET. Over here on the right, both of these capacitor currents flow through either of these guys. So we get these 6 1/6, 2 1/2, 2 1/3, knowing that a normalized charge through each cap was 1/6 once we did our AC vectors. Then we can just plug into our equation for the FSL output resistance. We got is something about 1.7 times the on resistance of any individual FET, assuming each of the FETs has the same on resistance in our implementation. Okay. And then we went through and validated in simulation, showed that across a range of frequencies, the FSL and SSL analytical predictions match up to the asymptotic behavior of this converter. Go to lower frequencies, we have this minus 20 dB per decade K over C fly FS type trend in our output resistance. At higher frequencies, it becomes constant, something 16/9 times R on. Frequency independent. In the middle, we transition from one to the other. Again, this is an approximate model of that transition, although it looks like when I rewrote this lecture slide, I didn't put in the squares. It should be this. Excuse me on that. The original PowerPoint slides were lost when it crashed, so I went and rewrote these so I could post them to the website. It looks like I missed those squares when I did that. Okay. And then where we ended last class was here. So we were talking about this hybrid Dixon converter where I put a big filter inductor at the output to make it look like this whole thing is current loaded instead of loaded by a bulk capacitor holding a constant voltage. And what we're discussing here is, okay, in the 2-to-1 converter, putting a big filter inductor at the output made it so that the flying capacitor was both charged and discharged by a current source. And we got the lower losses associated with that current source charging for all of our flying capacitor charging and discharging. Here in this Dixon converter, and more generally in any switch cap converter, adding a single inductor does not guarantee that we have nice current source charging of all the caps. So in these equivalent circuits of the Dixon in each subinterval, you see that adding a filter inductor cuts off what would have been a fixed voltage source. We don't have this voltage source type charging in loops going through the output, but we still have these loops where these capacitors can be shorted to one another, and that would still give us a voltage source or a CV type charging characteristics. On this top left loop here, if we short into this subinterval one, we'd be taking kind of these three caps in series, hooking them up in parallel with this voltage source, and we would again get this exponential charging characteristic that is a little bit higher loss than current source type charging. Same thing down here in subinterval two, these loops that go through the output are now nice current source type loops, but what about shorting these caps together? Do we lose energy in that process? And so started talking through this saying, okay, if there is no current in these purple loops, then the charge going through every individual FET is just going to be dictated by the DC solution of this circuit. And we have whether subinterval one or two, we have three branches that the current source loads. One of them has a single cap, potentially a voltage source, but that'll just be a zero impedance. And then two branches with two caps. What we'd like is the current to split in this way. Half the current flows through the branch with one cap and then a quarter in each of the other branches. Okay. So this down here where we ended was writing these charge vectors, assuming that's the case, assuming that all of the current that flows through these caps is just dictated by the current source splitting in this manner. And then we write the charge vectors, since we have I over four, noting that each is half the period, and just divide that by two to get our normalized charge vector, where we had a half plus a half, the total output charge is one, so we're already normalized here. And what we see is, okay, this can't work. Most notably right here on these caps at the either end of the circuit, we have normalized 1/8 charge going into the cap here or C1 in subinterval one, and then minus a quarter normalized charge coming out of it in interval two. These two things need to be equal and opposite sign in any two switching subinterval switch cap converter so that they balance. Whatever charge I pull out of it, I have to put back in steady state before the period ends. So this isn't going to work, and kind of makes sense if the current splits in this way and I have twice as much current in this caps as the other one, it's going to have a larger delta V. And that means I'm going to have some charge in these purple loops to balance everything out. Okay. Well, since switching subinterval one, C5 has a bigger delta V than C1 through C4, and then I switch into subinterval two, C5 needs to balance with these other caps. C2 and C3 both had the smaller delta V, and C4, when I short them together, there's going to be a voltage mismatch, and I'm going to have a big spike of current in this loop and get some additional hard charging loss. So it's not going to look like everything is just current source charged. Nice little loss. Okay. So we can go through and figure out with some additional math exactly what the current is in here, how much loss we have in that charging loop. But we're going to kind of make an argument here about how we could fix this and get complete soft charging or complete current source type charging these caps, eliminate any of the current in these purple loops that causes additional loss. And a full derivation and analysis is from this paper where they figured out this new switching sequence. We're just going to do kind of a intuition based argument here. And the key to it is, go to the next slide here, adding a couple more switching sub intervals. Okay, so one and two. And what we're going to do is, rather than having just the two switching sub intervals, we're going to add what could be called a 1B and a 2B switching sub intervals. I'm not going to redraw the whole circuit. I'm just going to say in 1B, all we're going to do is open a switch in series with either of these caps that are problematic, that are unbalanced. So we're going to open whatever FET will disconnect C1 from the circuit here in 2B. And we're going to open a FET that'll disconnect C5 from the circuit in 1B. Okay. And what that's going to do is just leave me these two remaining branches. So now all of the current will flow through C3 in series with C4 in parallel with C1 in series with C2 in this 1B, or through these four capacitors in 2B. Okay. What's that going to do is it's going to give me an equivalent charge vector where due to normalization, things will change around a little bit. But basically, all three of these caps will still be seeing current in both, but I'll have one interval now where C1 doesn't see any current, one interval where C5 doesn't see any current. These are the two things that were imbalanced in this solution, this postulate solution where we said, can this work? Concluded no. Right. So we can kind of come back and say, no, this won't work. But we can make it work if we could somehow balance C1 and C5 over additional sub intervals such that they have zero average charge. So I'm going to actually use these two charge vectors, but I'm going to have to combine them with two more. So I'm going to come back here and I'm going to copy our original results. A1 is equal to minus a quarter, 1/8 minus 1/8, 1/8 minus 1/8, and then a quarter, a half. A2 was equal to 0. Be a quarter minus a quarter. One half. And I'm going to add to that A1B and A2B, where I open these switches, in this case in A1B, I'm just disconnecting C5. And what that's going to do in this circuit, instead of having a quarter current through each of these caps, I'm going to have a half, which, because it's only half the period, is going to give me entries of a quarter in my remaining capacitors. So C1 through C4 will have the same signs, but be twice as much current here. Okay. Now the input, since C5 is disconnected, is going to go to zero. So I'll have 0, quarter, minus a quarter, quarter, minus a quarter, and 0, because C5 is disconnected, I'll keep my 1/2 here. A2B, same idea, still have 0 current at the input, but now C1 is going to have 0 current because it's disconnected. And then the remainder will follow what they were doing, but just with twice as much current. So I'm not quite there yet, but we're starting to see maybe I can do this. Okay, so now I've got these four different vectors to choose from, four different switching subintervals. And what I've got to decide now is how much time to spend in each of them so that everything will balance. You can kind of see for C2 through C5, for C2 through C4, we've got minus an eighth in A1, plus an eighth in A2, quarter in A1B, minus a quarter here and a quarter down here. So for these three, at least, as long as I spend an equal amount of time in A1 and A2 and A1B and A2B, these things will balance. Okay. Then for C1, I've got to kind of make up the imbalance caused by this 1/8 minus a quarter by adding in more of this A2B, balance things out. Same thing for C5 over here. Okay. So question is, can we find duty cycles for each of these four subintervals such that when we multiply all these charge vectors by their respective duty cycles, we end up with something that looks like, let's see, we want to have a vector here of D1, D1B, D2, D2B. We're going to multiply these four duty cycles by our four charge vectors. And what do we want to get out of it? We want to get some vector that is the total charge going into or out of each of these elements, and that should look like, we know, minus a 6, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1. Okay. So the section in the middle for all five caps, we should have zero total charge over the entire switching period. Should have unity charge at the output from our normalization. And we should have 6 times less charge at the input as a 6-to-1 converter. And turns out we can do this. This is generally, there could be multiple solutions to emit from this. We can find one simply by saying, okay, since A1 is balanced by A2 and A1B is balanced by A2B, let's make D1 plus D1B is equal to 1/2, and D2 plus D2B is equal to 1/2. We'll have still spend 1/2 the period in subinterval 1, just split that into subinterval 1 proper and this 1B, the other 1/2 either in 2 or 2B. And then we can go through and solve D1 because this is the only non-zero entry in this first column here. So the only time we're pulling current from the input is in A1. So this 1/4 times D1B has to be equal to 1/6. So we end up with a solution here. See, D1 is equal to 2/3. Equal to D2. And D1B is equal to 1/3 is equal to D2B.
Dr. Costanet?
Yeah.
In the second matrix with the A's, did you mean to put A2B twice?
Nope. This first one should be A1B. Sorry about that.
Yeah, all good. Just want to make sure.
Just these four stacked vertically. So we end up finding quickly this solution just by by some basic arguments, D1 and D2 are equal to 2/3, D1B and D2B are equal to 1/3. You add that up, we have four duty cycles, 2/3 plus 2/3 plus 1/3 plus 1/3 is 2. And that's because I kept my normalization here. I add these all up, half plus a half plus a half plus a half is too much. So we can actually just multiply these by all four by any constant we want, because it's all normalized. So we'll just divide it all by 2, or say these duty cycles are with respect to the half period. This tells us the relative amount of time we should spend in each of these. So I should spend my first half period 2/3 of the time in subinterval 1, 1/3 in subinterval 1b, 2/3 of the time in subinterval 2, 1/3 in subinterval 2b. Okay. So what is that going to do? I still don't have complete current source charging of every cap. I'm still shorting caps together. But this ensures that when I short those caps together, they're already at the same voltage. So there is zero charge exchange between them. And that exponential type current spike that goes in these purple loops has a peak of 0 amps. So it still exists, doesn't magically make it so that this loop is inductive. What it does is makes it so that zero charge flows in that loop. Okay. So putting this all together, adding in these different subintervals, I can now make it so that there is zero voltage source charging of capacitors. Everything is still charged by a current source. What's the trade-off there is I get a little bit higher peak currents. Okay. If I, assuming this, neglecting this exponential, but instead of having kind of a quarter of the current always flowing these through these two caps, now I have a little bit of time where there's a half of the output current flowing through them. So I'll see a little bit higher steady state current in these conduction intervals that I added, A2B, A1B. Depending on how big your capacitors are or how long your intervals are, that could be much better than having this exponential spike of current, or could actually hamper things a little bit if your caps are so large that there's nearly zero delta V and you just don't care about that hard charging, then putting a little bit higher conduction loss through your FETs may not be optimal. So that's the idea behind the split phase control. This publication will go into a lot more detail about how they derived it and showed exactly what these losses are. So it's just a functional argument, kind of already knowing the solution of adding these extra two subintervals. Okay. So here it is plugged into the same LTSPICE simulation, again showing something deep in the SSL, something in the fast switching limit, where I got there by increasing the capacitance and resistance. So this yellow and blue are the same two curves we've already looked at. So green curve is what happens if I add a huge inductor at the output, but don't do any of these additional switching subintervals. See, I still get a sizable benefit out of this. That benefit comes from, okay, things aren't shorted to an output voltage anymore. I reduce all of the charging that went to the output, but I still have some loss in these purple loops between the caps. And then this blue curve is when I go to split phase operation, using these additional subintervals, get rid of any current flowing in these purely capacitive loops and the exponential spike in current associated with them. Now everything is just charged from an output current. Modify this and draw that this is again a current I. Still assuming the inductor at the output, but we get still some additional benefit from going to the split phase control. Okay. Make sense? Any questions on that? One final thing on switch caps that I just wanted to make more of a qualitative comment and kind of mention this along the way. But all of this analysis still assumes that the switches are ideal, right? Our simulation here, we were looking at ideal switches with some on resistance, but no switching behavior. Their actual switching was ideal. No gate charge, no output capacitance, anything like that. when we start to look at real switches, there are additional switching losses. For a pure switch cap converter, not any of these hybrid implementations. And let's think about it operating in the slow switching limit. What happens? What type of losses do we have, and how does it compare to what we've done before? So if we're operating in the slow switching limit in, for example, this Dixon converter, means that in whatever switching subinterval we've gone into, I turn on G1, I get this exponential spike of current going through all of the caps, and that dies out to zero before the end of the period. So transferred the entirety of the charge to the output. So when I go to turn off G1, my current flowing through it has already died down to zero. So that means I should get a really nice turn off. And when I turn off, really nothing will happen in the circuit, right? Since there's no current flowing through that device, I shut it off and it's gonna sit there still with 0 volts. Everything's kind of in steady state, just sitting there. Okay. Then when I go to turn on G1, it's gonna happen in addition to everything else with all these other capacitors, all the spikes of current I get through the flying capacitors, I'm also going to have to suddenly get this top device to block, in this case, an output voltage. So I'm gonna have some COSS type losses associated with that. This device was blocking voltage, this device was not. As I turn this on, I'm gonna short out its output capacitance. And then from the input, I'm gonna charge the output capacitance of G1, of this top device, I should say. Okay, so we'll end up with kind of full COSS losses at turn on and a zero current turn off. Zero current turn off means this is approximately lossless in the turn off process and really independent of the speed of my gate driver. Even if I have a slow gate driver, because the current has died down to zero, as I turn off, nothing's happening. Okay. Turn on or these operations in a fast switching limit converter are a little bit different. Okay, we'll have these COSS losses, but then the question is, okay, like what about these overlap losses that we looked at back in lecture 7? So through this full analysis of this kind of triangular approximate overlap loss, and this was all based on the idea and the logic we used to solve this was that we have some half bridge with a fixed voltage across it and a fixed current flowing through it, at least for the duration of the switching, even if we were a resonant current here in the inductor or something with high ripple. During just the time that I'm switching from M1 to M2, that current is approximately constant the entire time. It's held by this inductance. And so we get this behavior where we have to take over all of the current. So we turn on, this is the turn on of M2 in this case. We have to take over all the current from M1, get it out of the body diode of M1 before M1 can begin to shut off. So we get this overlap type loss where we have the current rise first, then the voltage fall. In these pure switch cap converters, I have no inductor holding current through everything. I have some parasitics remaining, but the time constant flow should be comparable or faster than the actual switching dynamics. There's nothing that's holding a constant current during the switching time, which means that there's no reason the voltage and current can't change at the same time. And we'll end up with something, depends entirely on details of the parasitics, but instead of current rising first, then voltage falling, they'll kind of happen at the same time. Okay. I have no inductance, I only have caps or resistances in the fast switching limit. My current is entirely dictated by some series resistance, some combination of R on and the ESR of the cap. And it means that the current flowing through it changes with the voltage. We'll have current and voltage changing at the same time, and as a result, get a smaller peak on any overlap type losses that we have here. Okay. exactly what happens there depends on whether it's dominated by parasitic inductance or just the ESRs of these different loops. Just the ESRs of the different loops, then current and voltage will change proportionally. And we'll get about a factor of a quarter multiplying all of this because they cross at half of each. Get a factor of a third if it's a different type of switching. If it's inductive, will be dominated by the energy in that inductor and whether it rings or is lost out. But regardless, we don't have this type of overlap loss mechanism in these pure switch cap converters. We may have something remaining at turn off, something happening at turn on, but it won't be this trajectory that is derived from the idea that the current is held constant. Instead, we can get a trajectory where voltage and current are kind of changing at the same time because nothing is clamped, there are no diodes conducting. Okay. There can be losses associated with that. Generally, particularly in the slow switching limit, the dominant remaining switching losses are these COSS type losses. If we start pushing up higher and higher frequency, may have some issue with overlap type losses, the same kind of principles, but not conforming to this expression here, okay, because the current isn't clamped. So push higher switching frequency, those switching losses are going to be a problem. As we go higher and higher, they're going to get worse and worse, and they're going to be our limitation. And that loops back to this last topology that I mentioned that we're not going to go into a lot of detail on. But the switch tank converter, where we put resonant inductors on all these caps, purpose of that is then to get a half sinusoid type charging current, like we looked at for the resonant charging case, in each of these capacitors. And as a result, have the possibility for zero voltage switching, zero current switching of all of these FETs, depending on how we operate it, allowing that resonance to soft switch our devices and get rid of some of these dominant remaining switching loss mechanisms. We can push a little bit higher in frequency, a little bit smaller in passive values while maintaining good efficiency. And with that, that's all I plan to cover about switch capacitor converters. Any questions on that? If not, then the final topic I'm going to give an introduction to in this course is discrete time modeling. This is covered in detail in my ECE 692. 692 is a special topics course number, so there's a lot of different 692s, but the one that I taught last fall, we'll teach again likely next fall if everything goes according to plan, spends an entire semester talking about this discrete time modeling. So what we'll do in the next few minutes today and through most of Friday's lecture and possibly a little bit of Monday's lecture is just give an introduction to the concept of this, understand what it is and where it fits in the realm of our converter analysis techniques that we've developed. But if you want to learn more, that entire course will be dedicated to applying this for converter analysis. So the motivation for it comes if we go back to this kind of hierarchy of topologies and analysis frameworks that I presented earlier. At this point, you all are experts in what's shown here. So we've got our averaging analysis, kind of what we did in 481 or an introductory power electronics courses. We added charge vector analysis for switch cap converters in the last few lectures. That is still really just averaged analysis. All we're doing is saying integrate the total current through the cap to get a charge. Those charges have to sum to zero over one period, which is saying the average current in each cap has to be zero in steady state. So it's the same idea there. A couple modifications to make things a little bit easier working with just switch cap converters. Then we developed state plane analysis and talked some about sinusoidal analysis in this course. Okay. Each of these analysis frameworks has its limitations, though. They're well suited to analysis of converters under certain approximations, right? So sinusoidal analysis kind of assumes high Q tanks. So that my I of T and V of T are approximately sinusoidal. And in almost all cases where it's applied, those waveforms aren't purely sinusoidal, but maybe they're close enough. In our series resonant converter, we've looked at both, you know, simulations and state plane analysis and sinusoidal analysis. Those waveforms aren't purely sinusoidal. They're made up of segments of different sinusoids. If they're maybe close enough and under certain limitations, we can approximate them as sinusoidal. Right? State plane analysis was limited to single frequency resonance. Which was useful in a lot of converters, as we can break it up and say in each switching subinterval, I can have a different frequency, a different resonance, a different DC bias and initial condition. But still within each of those subintervals, we have to be able to approximate the converter as only having a single resonance and that resonance being undamped so that we can get any value out of state plane analysis, right? It made things nice and easy because we could use geometry and trig instead of diff EQs to analyze the waveforms within one subinterval. If we start adding resistances in, we've said on the state plane that'll look like a spiral, but it really breaks the utility of state plane analysis. We have to start analyzing spirals instead of just circular arcs. Okay. And then averaging, really limited by the small ripple approximation. And the idea foundationally that averaged waveforms are a good model of what's going on in the converter. Okay. Relied on the idea that we can kind of neglect the ripple of all other states when we're looking at a single state. We can solve back the ripple under some linearized approximations, but foundational to the model. Assume everything has very small ripple, everything's a filter element, and that the average behavior of the converter is a good representation of the full behavior with ripple when I actually build the thing. We'll talk a little bit more about the limitations of that averaging approximation. So we've got these different frameworks to analyze now. Each has built in some assumptions and limitations, approximations that limited in terms of where it can be applied. Averaging will make it so that if we try to look at one of these AC link converters with averaging analysis, we just lose the entire middle of the converter, all the AC waveforms that just inherently average to zero, go to zero, and our average analysis breaks. Sinusoidal, if we have a lower Q tank or something where we have multiple frequencies, it falls apart. State plane analysis, if we have damped or multi-resonant behaviors, we can't apply it easily. So question of when it's applicable and when it's okay to make those approximations. Combine these three, you'll kind of cover most of the cases you'll come across, but require some insight and intuition and keeping track of what those approximations are and will they hold. Discrete time analysis framework that I'm going to talk about now is more fundamental, becomes more numeric in nature. But the benefit of it is it's perfectly applicable to all of these cases. There are no approximations built in other than ones that are needed in order to obtain a result or of approximate the thing as a linearized system if we want to get transfer functions, or approximate the thing as a switch system. So it'll cover any topology equally, as no approximations on single frequency resonance or high Q tanks or anything else. To get to where this discrete time modeling framework fits in, we're going to talk a little bit about kind of where averaging came from and what the limitations are of the averaging analysis of switch converters that we use widely in the field. And that's become the mainstay of power electronics analysis. So what do we have in power electronics? The problem and what we're trying to address by any of these analysis frameworks is dealing with time varying circuits, right? So regardless of which of these frameworks we're working in, our starting point is saying, okay, I've got some converter that switches back and forth between a couple of different configurations. And in each of those configurations, I can approximate it as a linear time invariant circuit. So for this buck converter, I've got subinterval one, I've got subinterval two. Both of these equivalent circuits are LTI equivalents. So within one switching subinterval, these things are not so difficult, right? Either of these circuits individually is a circuits one type problem when it just has one inductor and one capacitor. If I had more than that, it'd maybe be a circuits two type of problem to solve. But I can solve the behavior of LTI circuits. That's our bread and butter as electrical engineers, right? The problems come in with switching back and forth between them, which creates an overall converter that is not linear time invariant. In fact, it's time varying because in time I'm switching back and forth, physically varying the circuit here between these two subintervals. So all these analysis frameworks are really meant to deal with, okay, how do I incorporate that time variance into the model of my circuit? Okay. So averaging, an average analysis is largely credited to this guy, Slobodan Chuk, who was a professor. He got his PhD at Caltech and later came back and was a professor at Caltech. Did a PhD dissertation under Dr. Robert Middlebrook, sometimes called kind of a father of power electronics. And he developed some of the early theory design-oriented methods for power electronics. And then Dr. Chuk popularized and kind of formalized average analysis of switching converters in multiple implementations. So the idea generally behind averaged analysis is, as you've seen many times, we are going to average the circuit, average these two subintervals, smash them together to get some average behavior of the circuit. Okay. In 481, we cover that extensively with waveform averaging. I talked a little bit earlier about switch averaging in applying our quasi-resonant and quasi-square wave type analysis to apparent PWM topology. We talked about switch averaging instead. And then here I'm going to talk about state space averaging, which is really kind of the main and original formulation of averaging. So the idea being, okay, we can take either of these equivalent sub-circuits and write the differential equations for it. Okay. Then I can take these differential equations and push them into a state space form. So my equations for this subinterval one of the buck converter are, I get a differential equation relating to the inductor, one relating to the capacitor currents are inductor current minus load current. The voltage on the inductor is VG minus VC. In general, all these things could be time varying. So I kind of combine that together and just pull out the derivative of my states on one side, which is what we normally call X dot, and write that as a function of some A matrix of constants times my vector of states, plus some B matrix of constants times any of my independent inputs. So I get the state space type equation, X dot is equal to AX plus BU, where A and B are constant matrices or vectors which describe the connections of the circuit. Okay. So you can see A here is this thing. This thing is B1. And inside we just have resistance, capacitance, inductance, and scale factors. Okay. So that's just combining these things together, kind of lump these derivatives, divide everything through by L, and then write it in this form. Okay. In subinterval 2, I can do the exact same thing. I'll get the exact same form of equation, but some different A and B matrices. I'll have A2 and B2 instead of A1 and B1, where A2 and B2 describe the connections in subinterval 2. Okay. So each of those is easy enough to analyze. Problems come in combining these two subinterval circuits together. So one way we can think of doing that is by introducing this switching signal S of T, which just goes between 0 and 1, and using that as kind of a selector in time of which equivalent subcircuit do I use. Then I could write a single system that describes the switching behavior like this, where I say A1 times S of T plus A2 times S prime of T, or 1 minus S of T. So then at any given time, if S of T is 1, this whole thing in brackets becomes A1. If it's 0, it becomes A2. Same thing for B, selects which of these two vectors to use at any given time. Okay. So now I've got some written kind of equation description of my overall circuit switching back and forth between these two equivalent subsystems using state space type analysis, matrices and vectors. We are pretty good, depending on how much you've used it, at analyzing systems like this, our linear time invariant systems, where I've got my states, all of my capacitor voltages and inductor currents in X, all of my inputs in U. These things can be time varying, but the behavior of the circuit is just constant matrices A and B. With what I wrote on the previous slides, A1 times S of T plus A2 times S prime of T, that is some equivalent matrix here that now varies in time as S changes back and forth. It jumps back and forth between A1 and A2. So it means I could say some equivalent A and equivalent B to all of this. My system looks like this, where now both the waveforms in the circuit and the inputs, as well as the circuit itself, are time varying. And that's something we don't like to deal with. This is some nonlinear state space description. We really like dealing with LTI circuits. Nonlinearities become way too complicated to work with. So this is kind of foundationally in switch circuits, which are power electronics, the problem we run into and why we've developed all these frameworks to deal with this nonlinear type system or time varying system. Okay. So in averaging, what Dr. Chuk came up with is say, let's take our system and assume that it can be approximated as some linear system. What we're going to do is find some different A and B matrices that approximate the behavior of all of this nonlinearity, all of this time variation. Okay. And eventually we're going to do that by averaging, but before we even get into how we do that, we can say, okay, what's that going to do to the circuit? Well, all of that nonlinearity came from switching back and forth between subinterval 1 and subinterval 2. So no matter how we develop this, if we approximate it as not having any switching action, we're going to remove the behaviors associated with that switching. We can get some equivalent based on something, but we're going to lose the dynamics of the switching. We're going to lose any sort of ripple, anything that was dependent on this thing switching back and forth. So we can talk about how to develop this linear equivalent, but we're aware even before we do that we're going to lose some behavior in doing so. Okay. So the idea in how we develop averaging analysis starts from the full model of the system. Let's just say we've got some converter that has two subintervals, 1 and 2, and I'm looking at some state of it, like some inductor current or some output voltage. the behavior of the switch system can look something like this plot, where we say, okay, in subinterval one, as we go through that subinterval, my state changes in some way described by A1 and A2. Then at this time, I switch. And in subinterval two, my state progression is dictated by this A2 and B2. I go to a different subinterval, different equivalent circuit, and how my states are changing in time changes according to that new circuit. Okay. In averaged analysis, what we do is we apply averaging to all of this. Okay. And we start by saying, let's use the average value of all the states and the average value of all the inputs instead of their instantaneous values to describe what's going on in any subinterval. Okay. That means is that, okay, instead of something that can have some dynamics, instead of using the real x of t such that it's changing in time, we're using the average value, which will just be constant. So that means that the progression here is just going to be a straight line. It's going to have a constant slope, and both of these subintervals can't have any of this kind of tailing off that I have in the real system. Okay. X of t and u or t are constant across either subinterval, now multiplying them by either a1 and b1 or a2 and b2. But I'm going to get straight line type ripple out of it. Okay. Then, okay, so x of t is some average over the entire period that I'm using to approximate what's going on in either subinterval. Okay. So if we can say that's a good approximation of what's going on in the circuit, so using the average value is going to make it so that the slope is constant during every individual subinterval. It's called the straight line ripple approximation or constant slope approximation. If my waveforms look like that, then perhaps I can use this average value to approximate the behavior of the circuit. Okay. So we're going to say, okay, using the average instead, I have constant slope. If my ripple on all of my states looks like triangle waves or something otherwise that is piecewise linear, then maybe I can use this average value to approximate it. Okay. If I plug in that average value instead of actual x of t and actual u of t, what I get is, okay, the system changes so that I have the average values in here. Because these things are no longer different between subintervals, I can add these together and kind of factor out. What I get rearranging is some system that looks like this, which is our average model. If we apply state space averaging, okay. A little bit over on time, so we'll stop there and talk a little bit more about this average system and then a better way to approximate the behavior of these switch systems, which is this discrete time modeling. We'll pick up there on Friday. Thanks, everybody.